This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. José Luis Jorge dos Santos lived a quiet life, a painter, a cook, a husband, and a father in an idyllic seaside town in Portugal. Then a fingerprint led investigators to conclude that he was actually George Wright, an American, a convicted murderer, and an alleged airplane hijacker who collected $1 million ransom and went on the run for more than 40 years. Wright now faces extradition back to the U.S. Until last month, Wright was among the 6,500 fugitives the FBI believes to be on the run. Today, life on the lam, what it takes to stay hidden and what eventually trips them up. If you've ever lived under the radar, how did you do it? Give us your story. Call 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, we'll talk with famed chef Jacques Pepin about his new collection of dishes, Essential Pepin. And we want to ask you a question. What have you ever learned watching a cooking show on TV? Send us an email now, talk@npr.org. But first, life on the lam. Victor Obojsky spent nearly 30 years tracking fugitives and retired as a supervisory deputy U.S. Marshal and joins us now on the phone from his home in Washington, Maine. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
George Wright stayed hidden for 40 years. What did he do right?
Well, what he did right was basically stay out of a life of crime. And obviously, he was able to get good identification. He probably broke most of his ties with his past. And he most likely had a lot of help, which I believe he did once he arrived in Algeria. And he tried to lead the kind of life that in the Marshal Service we want our relocated witnesses to lead. Yep. And that basically is, like you said, stay under the radar. Don't bring attention to yourself.
Don't become prominent in any way.
No, and whatever you do, don't get fingerprinted, which I think probably was his undoing.
And a fingerprint popped up because of an identification record, as I understand it.
Yes, I believe in the in Portugal they probably fingerprinted him because he didn't originate from there. And then when the investigators, who did an outstanding job in tracking him down, decided to see if there was any fingerprint matches, sure enough, they came up with a match.
How do people stay hidden?
Well, they stay hidden by, like I said, you know, breaking off ties with the past, starting a new life. He started a life with a woman that didn't even know his real past. He had children, and he presented a persona to the people around him that wouldn't lead them to believe that he was, number one, he was a murderer, or number two, that he may have hijacked a plane or do all these other dastardly deeds that he's wanted for in the United States.
And how do you find somebody who wants to stay hidden?
Well, that could be a long and arduous task. You just have to keep digging in. You just have to keep investigating, talking to friends, talking to relatives, trying to get known associates, trying to figure out who he may be with, try and get leads to see if he has fled to another country, if he fled to another country. You know, identify that country, contact Interpol, get them fingerprints, get them photographs, and all the things that you have to do as an investigator to try and put other law enforcement agencies on alert that this individual may be within their midst.
And how do a lot of these people are wanted on, for example, state crimes? Interstate cooperation is important, obviously getting the FBI involved, U.S. Marshal Service. What about internationally, as in the case of George Wright? Interpol, is that important?
Well, Interpol is very important, and obviously getting the federal agencies involved, because a lot of the state agencies and local agencies at the county level don't have the resources that the feds have. But getting Interpol involved, we have found in the Marshal Service, has been very advantageous, because they put out what they call red notices, which is a notice that goes to all the member countries. There's about 188 member countries. And there's red notices will flag a person that's traveling around. If you have a person that's traveling around from country to country, if he has a phony passport, which a lot of these fellows may have, that may not work. But again, the fingerprints and the photograph may alert local law enforcement in another country that this fellow is wanted.
There's a person currently on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, a man named Vector Manuel Garena, who's been on the run since 1983, accused of armed robbery of approximately $7 million from a security company in Connecticut, took two security employees hostage at gunpoint, then handcuffed, bound, and injected them with an unknown substance in order to further disable them. This is from 1983. Among the things they show on the poster is his computer-enhanced age.
Right. Well, I've been out about 12 years now. And since my retirement, the ability of being able to do all this electronic and computer enhancement and GPS and database searches has really improved dramatically. And it does, and that does help. I had a case to show you what the technology was like when I was working. We actually hired a fellow to do a bust of a fugitive, aging him.
Oh, you mean a statue of a bust?
Right, a bust. This fellow in Philadelphia had done it with people that were missing, or if they found a skeleton to see what the person may have looked like. Well, we hired him, the Marshal Service. We hired him, and we had him do a bust of a fellow that was missing for about 7 or 8 years. And on top of that, the individual, we knew he had a heart problem and he was a heavy drinker and a smoker, and he added that in. And then what we did is we took a picture of the bust. Well, when we finally located him in Hartford, Connecticut, and we showed the photo of the bust that had been made, the person we showed it to said, "Oh, yeah, that's him." They recognized it right off the bat. And he did look very familiar with as the bust that had been made, including the mustache that we had added on.
Victor Obojsky is telling what the search is like from the investigator's point of view. He worked for 28 years for the U.S. Marshal Service and retired as a supervisory deputy. We want to hear your point of view. If you've lived under the radar, what was it like? 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Rick's on the line. Rick calling us from Interstate 80 in Nevada.
Hi, how you doing today?
I'm good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I amassed a few drug charges in the late 80s, and I took off in 1990. And it was pretty easy to do then. I just I got a couple of states away from where I grew up at, and I just gave them a fake Social Security number when I wanted to get a job, or else I worked under the table. I was lucky enough to get a job on a fishing boat, which really gets you away from the authorities. And I waited it out about 4 years, and, you know, my attitude changed when I got off the drugs and came back and turned myself in. And when I left, I was looking at 9 years. When I walked into the local police station and told them my story, by the time court and everything else was done with, I wound up doing about 9 months in jail and about 3 years of probation at the county level. I didn't go to prison. And all in all, it worked out pretty good for me.
The fishing boat, obviously, the authorities are a long way away.
Yeah, and, you know, we got the Coast Guard on board a couple times, but, you know, just to check what we had in the hold and, you know, for safety stuff on the boat. I was never out. I mean, I had a fake ID. It was a state-issued ID. I just used someone else's birth certificate to get it. But I never really had to show it to anybody. The only thing I was really worried about was something stupid happening. And that would make them, you know, I got a couple of traffic tickets during that time. Mainly all I was worried about was winding up in jail and getting my fingerprints taken. But again, you know, that was in the 1990s. I mean, it's a lot harder to travel without a trail now.
I suspect you're right about that. But were you ever worried about, you know, the knock on the door?
Oh yeah, constantly. Just, you know, it never really leaves the back of your mind. Someone could be at your house and do something and get the cops called, and they want to talk to who lives there. You know, any number of things could happen. So sure, you're always a lot more careful, and you look over your shoulder. And it was kind of ironic. The little town that I went to when I ran, I actually got to know one of the local police officers there, and I'd run into him in the pub once in a while. We'd have a few beers, and the day that I left to come back, I told him I was leaving, and I'd known this guy a couple of years by now. You know, I'd been to his house. He'd been to my house. And I told him what I was doing. And I was just, you know, what am I doing telling a cop this? I'm going to go to jail right here. I'm not going to get a chance to turn myself in. But he just said, yeah, good luck.
Good luck. Okay.
I came back to turn myself in.
All right. Rick, congratulations. Glad you squirted all that out.
All right. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Jennifer Massia grew up, in a sense, on the run. Her father was a wanted man for a number of years. She wrote about that experience in her book, Never Tell Our Business to Strangers. She joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And you knew your father both as John and as Frank?
Yes, I did. Around the time I started remembering things, when I was old enough to repeat things, my mother drilled into me that my father was John inside the house, but outside the house we were to call him Frank. So I started believing that John and Frank were derivatives of the same name, like Bill and William or Richard and Dick. I thought it was the same name, and I was also told that I was to use a different last name in school, the last name of a friend of ours.
And it turns out your father was a fugitive.
Yes, he was. He had done time for murder before I was born. He was associated with the mafia in New York. And when he was released, he told my mother, who knew of his past. It was a new relationship. He turned his life around, started dating a school teacher. But he lapsed back into criminality, as is so often the case when you grow up in that life. And my mother was so in love and about to have a baby, and she kind of swallowed all of this, and he went back to cocaine dealing and in Miami. And he was arrested, and he knew he would go back to jail. Violating parole for a murder conviction is very serious. So he said to my mother, "This is it. Are you coming?" And she had an infant me in her arms, and she said, "You bet." And they ran. They ran to Houston and then California, which is where I grew up.
More about Jennifer Massey's life on the run as a child, her father as a fugitive. We'll also continue talking with Victor Obojsky, a former supervisory deputy U.S. Marshal. If you spent life under the radar for a while, call and tell us about it. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. When Boston mob boss Whitey Bulger was arrested in June after 16 years on the run, he was living a quiet, relatively public life in California. George Wright went further afield, but when police tracked him down in Portugal last month, he too was living a fairly normal, open life. He's now fighting extradition to the U.S. on 40-year-old charges related to airplane hijacking and escape from prison after a jury found him guilty of murder. The FBI says thousands of people are currently fugitives on the run. If you have lived under the radar, how'd you do it? Call and tell us your story, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Victor Obojsky, former supervisory deputy U.S. Marshal. He retired in 1999. Jennifer Massia is also with us. Her father lived on the run until she was 5 years old. She wrote about that experience in her book, Never Tell Our Business to Strangers. And 5 years on the run, Jennifer, you were obviously a little girl, but this has left scars.
I will never forget the day they came to take him away. And just like your call-in guest said, the knock on the door never leaves the back of your head. As an adult now, I realize how scared he must have been. But it just for the children, it's incomprehensible when you're that young.
How did living that life affect you and your mom?
Well, my parents' idea of a bank was to cut open the padding under carpet and just stuff money there and kind of pray it didn't flood. That you don't get involved in any kind of institution like a bank. Also fingerprints, of course. You're very wary of crossing the law in terms of especially with traffic, speeding tickets, exactly what your call-in guest just said. My mother inadvertently made it possible for the FBI to discover my father because she got a speeding ticket. And she said, "We were so stupid, we didn't get another car. They traced the VIN number on the car." Now, this was in the early 80s. It took 5 years for them to find him. Now it would take 5 minutes. No wonder George Wright went to Portugal. You'd have to.
Well, he was already overseas after he hijacked an airliner to Algeria. Victor Obojsky, I wanted to ask you, there's another person on the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitive list, Joe Luis Saenz. He's alleged to have shot and killed two rival gang members in Los Angeles. What is it like looking for somebody when somebody else may also be looking for somebody?
Well, obviously you have a time problem, because when they're looking for him and you're looking for him, you want to get him before they find him. That happened. I worked a number of organized crime cases in New York involving fugitives, and we did have organized crime people that were on the run, and the mob was looking for them because they didn't want it to become a rat. You know, they're always afraid that if a guy gets locked up, obviously the FBI is going to swoop in and say, "Hey, look, you got big problems. The best thing you could do now is cooperate." So a lot of times what they'll be doing is they'll say, well, look, we got to find this guy. We have to eliminate him as a possible witness for the future. So when you're looking for somebody and somebody else is looking for someone, you try to speed up your process, obviously. It was interesting in that first caller that you received, the one thing he was worried about was fingerprints. And in that case, obviously, what he did the smart thing by turning himself in, but also he wasn't involved in any crimes. He stayed out of a life of crime, which the vast majority of fugitives have a very hard time doing.
As Jennifer Macias' father did as well. But it was interesting, Whitey Bulger, the tip that finally got him was about, it was not, if you've seen this man, call the authorities. It's if you've seen this woman, his girlfriend.
Well, yeah, we would... when you start working up a case regarding looking for a fugitive, if you can find out who that fugitive is running with, especially a female partner, a lot of times that's your best lead. Your best lead is focusing on her, because if she's running with him, especially if she's a young girl, younger woman, I would say, she's going to stay in touch with her parents. I don't care how many times a fugitive will say, look, you can't call nobody, you can't contact. That girl is going to contact her mother or contact her father, especially your mother. So a lot of times the best thing to do is to go to the parents, because you know the parents of this young girl aren't too happy that she's running around with this bum who's wanted. And if you go to the parents and say, look, we're not interested in your daughter. We're really interested in who she's running with. Many times I have found that they're more than happy to help us, because they want their daughter back away from this guy, especially if he's a violent individual, and they want her home and away from this bum.
Let's see if we get another caller in. This is Scott. Scott with us from Reno.
How do you do?
Well, thank you.
All right. I was on probation, and there was no work in the town that I was on probation in, so I split probation for a couple of years, packed saddles and bridles, and went into the heartland of Montana and Wyoming looking to train horses, and just kind of bowed out of the legal system. I guess I'm calling to say that the legal system never gives up.
Huh. Did they find you?
They found my father, and they showed up at the door. And he didn't know how to lie quick enough and kind of put them on my trail, and I apologized to him for putting him in that place. And to get it out of the family loop, I turned myself in, did my time, and I am now off of probation.
Well, congratulations for that. But when you found out that they were on to you, what did that feel like?
I packed up things as quickly as I could. I had a little fifth-wheel trailer on the back of a truck and drove out of town, and rumor had it, they checked within 10 or 15 minutes. They were right there.
And
it's a little scary.
I bet. It's also when you decided to give yourself up, why eventually did you make that decision?
Again, to relieve the burden on my family. That the police, and unless you can convince them you're dead, the computers aren't going to forget your record, and they'll hunt you down.
Victor Obojski, did anybody ever try to fake their death in your experience?
No, I really haven't. I haven't really run into that with people that actually try and fake their death, or even really drastically change their appearance through plastic surgery. They may gain weight, lose weight, facial hair on or off, or hair color, but to that extreme, that's not the case.
You've ruined a lot of movie plots there. So
yeah, and like this caller that whose father gave him up, family members of the vast majority of them are law-abiding people, and they don't like cops coming to their door, and that is a tactic. You know, keep going back to the family members. And I've told people, look, I'm going to put wanted posters up all over. I know he's not around here, but I'm going to put wanted posters up all over the place. And they look at you and go, why? Because I want everyone to know that your son's wanted. They'll say, well, let me see if I can help you. So you try and use a little pressure on the family, which obviously was done with the father in the last case. And you try to put a little pressure on the family to say, look, cooperate, because we are not going to go away. We're going to keep coming back.
Scott, thanks for the call, and glad you cleared it up.
You all have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go next to, this is Yuri. Yuri with us from Phoenix. Yuri, are you there? Yuri, one more time. Let's see if we go next to, this is Michelle. Michelle with us from Eureka in California.
Hello.
Hi, Michelle. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I was on the run for about 2 years, and it was because I was a drug addict, and I was afraid of the withdrawal I'd have to go through if I went to jail. But my main thing was never riding in cars, because if the car gets pulled over, your ID is going to get run. And also, if I ever did encounter a cop, I'd always flatter them. I'd always say, oh, your job is so hard, and you have to deal with such crazy people. And then somehow they felt like I wasn't a threat.
And if you don't never ride in a car, life can be difficult.
Well, I took the bus. I ride my bike. But I eventually turned myself in, and it wasn't that bad.
And it wasn't that bad. And you got clean, and that's the important thing.
That was how I got clean, by the crash I went through in jail. So it was good for me.
And what was it that made you make the decision?
You know, life got redundant. You get up in the morning, you go cop, and then you get high, and then you wait until you got to go cop again, and I just didn't want to live that cycle anymore.
Congratulations, Michelle.
See you later.
Bye-bye. Jennifer Massia, did you ever get the feeling your dad wanted to live a normal life?
He did and he didn't. When he was on the lam, he was a law-abiding citizen. For those 5 years, I think it was the best thing that ever happened to him. He taught himself a trade. He learned how to repair carpets by reading a book. And he started a business, again, off the radar. But I think that in that respect, we were very lucky because I had the best of him. And funny enough, it was when he got caught, did his time, which, again, was not as much time as would have happened 5 years earlier. You know, after he got caught, it became easier to lapse back into criminality because he became like everyone else in a way. You know, he wasn't minding his P's and Q's so much. But he hated waking up early in the morning. He, in a lot of ways, he liked to cut corners. He used to say, I don't want to be a regular Joe Schmo.
Regular Joe Schmo. It makes the rest of us feel wonderful, doesn't it?
Well, I'm a Joe Schmo now, and I'm proud, so.
All right, let's see if we can get another caller in on the conversation. Let's go to Corey. Corey with us from Richland in Washington.
Yes. I was caught for a DUI in 1990, I believe it was. And I pled guilty to the charge and, paid my 2 years worth of money to the state for probation and went through a kind of a pretty lame thing to try to get you out of drink and alcohol and all that kind of stuff.
A rehab program, yeah.
Yeah. Well, after that, they still wanted more money, and I just decided to drop off the radar. I went for 5 years driving virtually every day, but what it taught me was don't get pulled over. You know, made me a very good driver. I did get picked up in 96 for something really stupid. I was driving through a speed trap, and I knew it was a speed trap, but I wasn't paying attention. I had my new girlfriend, who later became my wife, and as the gumball machines came on, I realized that I'm going to jail. I'm trying to explain to her that I'm going to jail, and she didn't believe me, and whatever. But then when she managed to bail me out of jail at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning in a town she'd never been in, I decided she might be a keeper.
I think you lucked out, yeah.
But anyway, my the moral of the story was, after I did get popped and I got sent back to court, I found out that my evaluation had been done by the wife of the judge that sat before me, and they had already thrown out dozens of cases because of that, and they basically let me go because I had been, you know, clean and sober and hadn't been a bad boy for 5 years, so I basically walked out of there free and clear, I guess you could say. Although, like I say, to this day, I stop at every stop sign. I signal every lane change.
Victor Obojsky, maybe you just should stop everybody who's obeying all the speeding laws.
Yeah, that would be sounds like a good deal.
Now I get so irritated when I see people doing stuff that I used to do 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Corey, thanks very much for the call. Stay straight. We're talking about fugitives and life on the run. Our guests are Victor Obojsky, who worked as a deputy U.S. Marshal, and with Jennifer Macia, whose book is Never Tell Our Business to Strangers. Her father was a fugitive on the run until she was five. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller in on the conversation. Let's go to, this is Paul. Paul with us from San Francisco.
Hi. My parents were fugitives in the 50s because we were running from the FBI. My parents were union organizers in the Communist Party. And I spent a lot of time as a fugitive. We would move every year. I remember one time the FBI coming to the door, and my mother told me, tell them to go away. So I opened up the door and said, just go away from my house, and slammed the door in the face of the FBI. And so we would live in one place, and my father would live in the next town over in order so that he could find work and not be followed.
And so
I ended up teaching a course. I now teach a course on how to be a fugitive.
Really? People take lessons in this?
Yeah, and there's always an FBI agent sitting in the class. They pay for it just like everybody else does, but... There still are a lot of people trying to run from their bills.
Running from bills, that's not quite the same as armed robbery or again, the FBI. But Jennifer Macia, have you thought of ever teaching a course on how to be a fugitive?
God, it's so painful. I definitely include a psychological component. I mean, I think it's... Although, you know, by listening to this broadcast so far, you'd think that just going somewhere for 5 years, waiting for the case to get cold, and coming back, and, you know, you'd get much better treatment than when the case is still hot, but, yeah.
Well, Victor Obojsky, you were on the catching side, not the prosecution side, and they were the ones making deals like that, but is that generally the case if it's gone cold and you're either caught or turn yourself in after 5 or 10 years?
Certain crimes, sure. I mean, not for murder, not for rape, not for a serious armed robbery. I mean, you're not what you're talking about now in a broadcast aren't real crimes that would necessitate someone going away for 15 or 20 years. But on the other hand, if you turn yourself in, that's the first step towards contrition, I would say. The other thing is, if you can demonstrate that you haven't been in any problem, and you haven't had problems up until that one time, and you haven't had any more problems, or you have been involved in committing any more crimes, well, obviously that'll be taken into consideration. They'll take a look at you and go, well, look, this person probably has reformed themselves, and obviously that's what the defense attorney would tell a judge. And yeah, they may actually give you something a little more lenient than you may have received when you were first arrested. That is a possibility. But then, like I said, that would depend upon the crime, and also would depend upon your criminal history. If you've been a lifelong criminal, the fact that you've been gone for 5 years, they're not going to really care a lot. They're going to say, this guy, you know, who knows what he's been up to in the past 5 years.
Yeah.
But if you're pretty clean up until that point, like the fellow with the DUI.
Right.
Yeah, they may turn around and give him a slap on the wrist and say, well, you know, you really have led an exemplary life. Now, I don't think that's going to be the case with the fellow in Portugal who's already been convicted of murder
And still faces trial for hijacking an airplane. So
yeah, right. So I think I don't think that they'll say, well, look, he's been living a very quiet life in Portugal. We'll give this guy a pass. I don't believe that's going to happen with him.
Paul, thanks very much for the call, Paul. And Victor Oboyski, thanks for your time today. And Jennifer Messia, her book is Never Tell Our Business to Strangers. We appreciate your time as well. Jacques Pepin, when we come back, stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.